Today's Taisho will be on case 30 in the Mumonkan, the Wu Menkuang. Case 30 is entitled Basso's This Very Mind is the Buddha. Dai Bai asked Basso, "What is the Buddha?" Basso answered, "This very mind is the Buddha." Mumon's comment, "If you directly grasp Basso's meaning, you wear the Buddha's clothes, eat the Buddha's food, speak the Buddha's words, do the Buddha's deeds. That is, you are the Buddha himself. However, alas, Dai Bai misled not a few people into taking the mark on the balance for the weight itself. How could he realize that even mentioning the word Buddha should make us rinse out our mouths for 3 days? If a man of understanding hears anyone say, this very mind is Buddha, he will cover his ears and rush away. Mumon's verse, the blue sky and bright day, no more searching around. What is the Buddha, you ask? With loot in your pocket, you declare yourself innocent. So thank you, everybody, for your deep practice this morning here in the Zen Hall. People were sitting very, very deeply, really beautiful to see. You know, when you get up in the morning, you know, this is such a wonderful way to start the morning, right? To get up and do deep, sit in deep samadhi, deep ding, and deep, 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 you know. And also online, people are sitting so beautifully. I can see all of you. Nobody's moving a muscle. It's wonderful to see. So if all the other sutras and commentaries and all the temples, everything was destroyed, if this koan survived, the Dharma would survive. It's such an important koan. One way to understand Buddhism is that it's a religion. It's a religion. So you have Judaism, you have Christianity, you have Islam, right? And Jewish people believe that the Jewish Bible was the first 5 books of the Jewish Bible written by Moses. So the first 5 books of the Jewish Bible are like the teachings of Moses, right? And they're written down. You know, there's the 10 Commandments and there's commentary, there's a huge volume of commentary. You can study the commentary. And people argue, you know, what did this mean here? When the Lord says this, what does it mean? And you have the commentary, you like volumes of commentary. Christianity, you have the teachings of Jesus, you have the Gospels, right? And a lot of commentary. And Islam, you have the Quran, right? Muhammad dictated the Quran. God is speaking, and basically the Quran are supposed to be the words of God, words of Allah, right? So there's like a revelation. Now here's the truth, right? Here's the truth. Write it down and study it, and commit it to memory and apply it to your life. See, and those are all familiar, familiar ways of familiar, right? Religion, that's a religion, sort of. But Buddhism is really interesting. I would say really somewhat different. It's definitely the truth that the world honored one delivered discourses, right? I mean, the suttas, the early, the Pali suttas and the agamas, You know, that's quite a bit. There's like 80, you know, there's a lot of like 80 volumes or something of comment of this the Pali canon, that all the Pali texts, you know, fill about 80 volumes. It includes lots of things like the Jataka tales, all these other things. And you also have like the Mahayana sutras. You have all of these sutras, so many sutras, you know. You have the Prajnaparamita sutras. You have the Yogacara sutras, you know. You have things beyond that, right? You have all the Chinese Buddhist commentary and the koans, right? So, you know, also the in Sanskrit it's called Buddha Vakana, the words of the Buddha. See, so, basically, if you want to be a Buddhist, you can study Buddha Vakana. And you can read the, you know, we, in our sutra study group, we spent about a year reading some of the major Pali suttas, right? And now we're reading in our study group, the Diamond Sutra. We're going to read the Lankavatara Sutra. We've read the Shorangama Sutra. You know, we've read all these sutras. You know, so you could say, well, Buddhism is just a religion, just like all the other religions, right? But you know, I think it's different. You know, because the Buddha didn't actually just say, here are my words, commit them to memory, right? Commit them to memory and try to apply them to your life. He did do that, but he also did something else. He says, you know, you can study my words, but please go where I went. See? So studying my words, yes, but please go where I went. You know, that's really different, you know. The Buddha says, all of this, these are just like a roadmap to enlightenment. And, you know, you can benefit just from studying the roadmap. So you know, if you read the Diamond Sutra, you know, it's so inspiring and so beautiful. You know, you could apply it to your life and it would help you. If you read the early Pali Suttas, the Agamas, you know, in Sanskrit, you can apply. The Buddha talks about all kinds of things. He talks about just many aspects of daily life when he's talking to ordinary people. One time a woman said to the Buddha, I don't have time to meditate. And he said, well, just when you're working in the kitchen, just watch your hands. Just be mindful of your hands. And, you know, when you're mindful of your hands, you know, you enter sanmai, you enter ding, you know, just watching, just being awareness of your hands. So, Buddha has lots of practical teaching, but I think Buddhism is really distinctive because, you know, the Buddha is saying, you know, basically, as I understand him, he's saying, you know, it's not enough just to study my words. It's really important for you to become an enlightened being. See, and I think that's really amazing, right? You know, it is true that the Buddha did lay out a path, right? He laid out a path and he keeps laying out various paths for people. So, you know, in the early Buddhist texts, the Buddha lays out his meditation path, right? He says, he talks about something he calls the jhanas. These are states, you could say states of concentration. And he said, you know, basically when I resolved to wake up, you know, I entered the first jhana, which is just state of consciousness you enjoy when you're in a quiet place, right? You're calm and quiet in a quiet place, and you appreciate, oh, it's so calm and quiet here, right? And then there's a jhana of, like, you could say, like, contemplation. And then there's a jhana where thinking stops. And there's another jhana. Those are called the four jhanas of form. And then there's these four formless jhanas, right? And there's one of those jhanas is like emptiness, like nothingness. And then there's a jhana where there's no time. And then there's a jhana where there's, you know, infinite space. And then there's a jhana where you can no longer tell the difference between consciousness and unconsciousness. It's just that state of consciousness is so refined that even that distinction doesn't make any sense. And then the Buddha says, basically, that he says, after going through the four jhanas of form and the four formless jhanas, he experienced, he says, the deathless or the unborn. You know, and then he set about teaching. And what he said about teaching was how to go to the deathless or the unborn. I think, quite distinctive. You know, the Buddha provided a method, a roadmap, and he said, this is how it's done, and now you should do it too. See, that's a wonderful, but actually, I would say problems can arise, right? Problems can arise because, what can happen is that the map becomes the destination, if that makes any sense. You know, if you are a Theravada Buddhist, you know, when you sit down on the cushion and you begin to meditate, you can say, now I have to enter the first jhana. Now I have to enter the second jhana. Now I have to enter the third jhana. Now I have to enter the fourth. Now I'm going to go, see. My feeling is that I've known a fairly large number of Theravada monks, you know, and I'm not criticizing them. But I have noticed, many years ago, our Sangha used to have a very close relationship with a Sri Lankan community. They have a big Buddha on Route 27. I don't know if you saw the newspaper article about that. But they used to invite me to their to teach meditation at some of their events. I had a chance. I've known a fairly large number of Theravada monks, and I was surprised that many of them, they aren't really seeking enlightenment. You know, it's like, really, you're not seeking enlightenment? You know, they feel that their job is to study the sutras, right? And actually, a very small number of them actually meditate. You know. And they mostly perform necessary functions for their community, which I think is very positive, right? So, when somebody dies, they go and they conduct a funeral service for that person's auspicious rebirth, and they do other things of that kind. They remind people to be good people. They instruct them in Buddhist morality, and all of that's wonderful, but it's like, wait a minute. Isn't this all about waking up? Isn't this all about... So one of the dangers is that the path, the path becomes the goal, right? Basically, you can go, as long as you're good at going through the jhanas, you may not have had the breakthrough like the Buddha. You may not have seen the deathless, but at least you know how to get there, right? This is a danger for Buddhism, right? You know, if people ask me, years ago I was asked to give a talk on Buddhism and on Zen. And one person came up afterwards and he was really angry at me. He said, you know, you never talked about the Four Noble Truths. You never talked about the Eightfold Path, you know. And he was really mad, right? He felt that I had really misled people. I hadn't really represented Buddhism. But what I talked about instead was not knowing, you know. I think when Buddhism came to China, you know, they built, you know, Chinese people have done a wonderful job with Buddhism. You know, yesterday or the day before yesterday, I said, you know, Chinese people have been Buddhist longer than Indian people, right? The Sangha is still flourishing in China today in spite of all the persecutions. It's really like wonderful. I think when Buddhism came to China, right, people took it really seriously. You know, they worked on translating the sutras. You know, they took it really seriously. You know, there were like very, very capable Indian and Chinese scholars who collaborated on translating the sutras just right and conveying the meaning in a Chinese context, right, you know. And, you know, people like we've talked, when Damo came to Liang, he met Emperor Wu of Liang. And Wu of Liang was a real person. He did wonderful things. He built these beautiful temples, libraries. But, you know, I think Zen comes along in China and it recognizes the danger, right, of making the path the goal. You know, so you can read all of these sutras, you know, you can study the sutras, and you should. I think it's essential to read the sutras, you know, and that's why we're doing it in our group. But on the other hand, you know, reading the sutras is like a travel manual. You know, when you read the sutras, it's like, you know, I have all these travel books, even to places I haven't been. So like I have a book on Sri Lanka, which I've never been to, and I've read it from cover to cover several times. And I have Sri Lankan friends, and I'll say things, and they'll go, oh, so you've been to Sri Lanka? And I'll say, oh, no, I never have, you know. But I read that book, you know. But I haven't been. See, I haven't been. It's not the same. Reading the book is not the same thing as going there, right? So you know, it's important. You can't get there without a map, right? You can't get there without a map. But if you when you read the map, you're not really there, right? So I think what happens is people become attached to the map and they don't go. They don't go there themselves, see? And I think that's what Chan or Zen is all about in China. In fact, I think Matsu is really one of the great innovator. I think he saw this problem, right? He saw this problem that people get attached to, you know, method, they get attached to the path and they forget about the goal, you know. In America today, mindfulness is like so popular, you know. If you go to the bookstore, you go to Barnes & Noble, there's like a whole thing. It's like mindfulness this, mindfulness that, you know, mindfulness, mindful making dinner, mindful driving your car, right? And if you say to somebody, what mind are you making mindful? Or what is this mind that you're cultivating? They have no idea, right? It's like the map has become, the path has become the goal, right? And I have known people, you know, who have gone to mindfulness retreats, and you some people, you know, you can certainly wake up following the early Buddhist techniques. You can. I've met people who have seen the Dharmakaya face to face, who are Theravada practitioners. I have. I think it's probably the case that people who practice American mindfulness may, although I have not met such a person, may have had a breakthrough and seen the source, seen the mind root, right? But you know, it's a sort of human nature to get attached to techniques, right? Techniques. I have also known in American Zen circles people who are attached to posture, right? So, you know, when they sit on the cushion, they have impeccable, you know, often these are people who have had Japanese teachers, and they have impeccable posture. So their back is so straight that if you put a board behind them, it would be absolutely straight, you know, and they're back perfectly balanced, and their hands are folded in their mudra of it's like you're holding an egg in your hand, that mudra, right? And they, you know, spend a lot of time on their posture, right? And, you know, when they eat, they do a very formal, it's called orioki. We don't do that here. Very formal way of eating. Every step is, I wear raksu, not kesa, because it's easy, right? But there's a certain way to put on and take off your robe, your kesa, this golden robe, right? And, you know, we get really good at your, all of these things are important. You know, if you're going to eat, thought, you know, be present. Don't make a lot of noise with your bowls. You should be cleaning your bowls very quietly. You should be very focused. You know, when you eat, your mind should be an ushin, you know? And then you really taste your food, yeah, all of that. So I'm not criticizing discipline or structure. I'm not criticizing, you know, we have a schedule here, very structured, right? You know, at 5 o'clock, you know where you're supposed to be in the zendo. At 8 o'clock, you know what you're gonna do. You're gonna eat breakfast, you know, highly structured. Yes, yes, yes. Discipline is so indispensable. But not enough, right? Not enough. So I think, you know, one of the reasons that Buddhism has flourished in China so brilliantly, really, is because of Zen, because of Chan. I think Chan is the highest spiritual achievement of human beings. That's my opinion. And what it does is it says you need a path, but don't become attached to the path, because you can't really, there's no method for encountering the Buddha mind face to face. There's no method, right? That you need a method. You need a method, but it won't get you there. It's like at some point you need discipline, you need to get, if you don't get up in the morning, nothing will happen. If you don't learn to do zazen, nothing will happen. So, but you can do all those things and still not see Buddha face to face, because you have to be in not knowing. You have to be in uncertainty, see. So you know, I see Matsu coming along and saying, wait a minute, you know, we have beautiful temples, we have we have, you know, libraries. We have guest speakers from India, coming from India and delivering lectures. And you have powerful people like Wu of Liang, you know, sponsoring guest, great monks from Nalanda, right? But the heart of Buddhism is not knowing, wuxing, right? And this is what I think Matsu is really getting at. See, what he's really getting at. So a monk asked Vaso, Matsu, what is Buddha? And he really says, your mind at this moment is Buddha. Now, you know, that what he's saying, in other words, is, you know, it's not your knowledge of the sutras, although you should know the sutras. It's not your command, you know, your technique, your sitting technique, although you should have good posture when you sit. You know, you should breathe through your dantian, you know, etc. But it all comes down to your mind, see. And people who read this koan think they understand the koan. They think, remember that every koan has a kind of trap or trick in it, right? So you know, when Vaso says, your mind is Buddha, this very mind is Buddha, people think, oh, I know what my mind is. But actually, you know, if you sit down on the cushion and you look for your mind, it seems so obvious that we have a mind, right? It seems so obvious, right? But when you look for your mind, where is it? What is it? See? So you know, basically, Matsu has done something really clever, right? He hasn't told Dai Bai, here's how to get to enlightenment. He's given him instructions that are kind of like going to fail. They're going to fail. He's creating a contradiction, and that contradiction is going to be Dai Bai's opportunity to have a glimpse of Buddha mind, right? So maybe Dai Bai hears Matsu say this, and he says, oh, that makes perfect sense. You know, we're meditating. Of course, Buddha is mind. But you know, when you sit down on the cushion and you go into deep wuxing, and you look for your mind, where is it? You know, and whose is it, right? So yesterday I mentioned, you know, we all believe that we are in charge of our own minds, our own consciousness, right? And a lot of people practice mindfulness as a way of controlling their minds, right? So a lot of American people believe, you know, American people like to quote unquote improve themselves, right? So they like, you know, a lot of Americans like to have like a Fitbit, you know, those things you wear on your arm, and they tell you how many steps you've taken every day. Not, if you have one, I'm not criticizing, they're fine, they're excellent. But, you know, it's like people get upset, they say, I haven't done my 10,000 steps today, right? You know, and I myself, you know, do that sometimes too, right? But, Americans practice meditation also in that spirit. It's like, I should not have a wandering mind. I should not have an undisciplined mind. I should not have a flabby mind, right? I should not have a weak mind. I need to strengthen my mind, see? So of course, all of that, none of that is getting you closer to mind, right? To what Matsu is talking about. You know, what you're creating are more ideas about mind, see? So you're creating an idea of the mind, and you're trying to find that idea, but that's a phantom, it's a dream. you know, you're only creating an image of your mind, but you're not getting any closer to your mind. So, you know, I mentioned yesterday, you know, we feel like our minds belong to us, but you can't control any of the content of your mind, actually, you know? You know, if you sit down on the cushion and you say, you know, I need to focus on my breath and have no thoughts. I need to be totally thoughtless. You know, good luck with that, right? Good luck with that. You might say, well, sometimes I'm in a totally thoughtless state, but actually just thinking that is a thought, right? You know, the interesting thing is that thoughts come into your mind. You can't predict what they're going to be, and you can't say where they go, right? So, you know, basic aspects of the mind, of what we call our mind, are not clear to us, right? And so, you know, I call it my mind, but it's really not mine. You know, it's not something I can actually control. It's true, you know, I can learn French, or I could, if I really studied hard, I could learn another language. But, you know, actually the experience of mind is really something, the more you look at it, the more you confused you're going to become, see. And this is really what Mao Tzu wants Dai Bai to do, to get confused, right? You know, we start out thinking, I know what my mind is. And then, you know, the more we sit and look for the mind, the harder it becomes to find the mind. And finally, we're in this place of not knowing, right? Not knowing. And now it's possible to free ourselves from all of our learning, mental mental habits, and you begin to enter, like you could say, a different state. You could say a different state of consciousness, right? And this is where we Zen people spend a lot of our lives, right? Liberating ourselves from our habits, our habit energies, liberating ourselves from our ideas, and you know, liberating ourselves even from the idea of mind, right? You know, there's another koan in this collection. This is case 33. It also features case 30 is a monk asked the Buddha, a monk asked Basso, what is the Buddha? Basso said, this very mind is the Buddha. And then on 33, a monk said to Basso, what is the Buddha? And Basso says, no mind, no Buddha. See, no mind, no Buddha. So, you know, this contradicts the instructions he gave earlier. You know, some people think about Zen practice as being like this. You're ignorant and unenlightened, and then one day you'll be enlightened. And after you're enlightened, you no longer have to do any zazen. You know the truth, et cetera, et cetera. So I think lots of people start out on the path that way. In fact, I did myself. I thought, you know, enlightenment is something I'd like to achieve or attain. And when I become enlightened, I can retire from practice, right? And, you know, in the early days of my training, it was very hard to sit. Meditation was very hard for me. My legs hurt all the time, you know, many problems, right? And I thought, well, at least when I get enlightened, I won't have to do this anymore, right? I'll be told I know all things, etc. You know, as I've been practicing for 50 years, I realize it's not quite like that. You know, practice never stops. Never stops. Never stops. You can stop, you know, you can stop anytime you want. But, you know, you can follow the Buddha's path, this path of liberation, forever and ever. You know, Wenang, we recite his verses, his four verses, every night at the end of sitting. And one of the lines is, Buddha knowledge is infinite. I vow to learn it all. You know, how big is the Dharmakaya? How big is Buddha mind? Very big. It's infinite, right? And so the idea of practicing forever might seem like, oh, you're kidding. But actually, it's absolutely wonderful. Every time we break free from our, you know, humans are a little bit like oyster, you know? Oyster, you know, an oyster in the water. Oysters secrete a shell, right? Because the sand is irritating for them, right? And they secrete this shell, and the shell protects them, right? But it also closes them in, right? So, you know how tough it is to open a oyster shell, right? Oysters are frightened of the world, you know, so they secrete a shell and protect themselves by closing. Human beings secrete ideas and symbols and images, right, to protect ourselves. And we gradually close ourselves into this, you know, until the real reality disappears. And we're in a world that's completely artificial, yeah? So we're like that oyster, only we secrete ideas and thoughts, you know. In Zen practice, what happens is that teacher gives us a koan and creates a contradiction, a big split in our world. It cuts us in two, and we have a breakthrough. See, it's like you have a glimpse of the source of mind, mind root, the awakened, enlightened mind, just a little glimpse. And then, you know, being the humans that we are, we start closing it up, and eventually we're a little different, but we've closed it up again. And then we work on another koan and we have a glimpse, see, and then we close it up a little bit, right? I hope I'm making some sense, but you know, sometimes in your practice, if you are working on a koan and you have a breakthrough, something might happen to you that's really amazing, right? You might, you know, you might come into the Dokusan room and say, years ago I had a person who was working on a koan, and he came in and he said, oh my gosh, my body feels like electricity is flowing all through my body. It's a very good response to the koan. And I said, that's wonderful, you know. So, you know, the next day he came back and I said, how's it going with your practice? He said, oh, I'm so disappointed. The electricity is gone, you know. See, he opened up for a moment and had an experience of fundamental reality. And then he created an idea or an expectation of what it was supposed to be. And when he sat down, he got up at 5 o'clock in the morning the next day, he was sitting there thinking, oh, I want to repeat that wonderful experience I had. Bring on the electricity, see. But that's just an idea. Now he's created a map and he's no longer going to the place, if that makes any sense, see. So now he's created a mental image. You know, we humans do that. We need mental images. But, you know, the path of liberation is always to cut away. Each time we have a breakthrough, we close it up a little bit, and then we open it up again, and then we close it up little by little. It's not always back to the same place. Little by little, we see more and more of we say big mind, more and more of enlightened mind, right? It's like each koan is a little glimpse of enlightened mind. We open up and then we close up. And then we open up a little bigger and close up. And then we open up a little bigger. See, and that goes on for a long time. Eventually, you know, you see the source face to face. We, in Japanese, that's called Daikensho, great awakening, right? But you know, even after your great awakening, whatever people say, even after your great awakening, you can close up again. You know, you can close up. You have to, at one point in my life, I was training with a teacher, and he said, you know, if you don't continue to enter Ushin and cut away, your awakening becomes just a memory. See, just becomes a memory, a mental image. So, you know, even the Buddha, we know from, even the Buddha got up every morning and meditated. And you say, he's the Buddha. Why does he need to meditate? You know, because, you know, we humans create mental images, and then we have to cut away with the sword of Wenshu, Manjushri. And every time we do, the world gets bigger for us, and it never stops, never stops. You know, in Zen tradition sometimes, the path to Daikensho is called the way up the mountain. The path to seeing the source is, then the path to integrate everything into that luminous awareness is called the path down the mountain, see. And some Zen teachers say the path down is more, even more beautiful than the path. So you know, it's even more beautiful than the path up. So you know, it's possible to say, endless practice. Oh, that's, you know, you mean my legs are always going to hurt? You know, well, actually, your legs won't always hurt. They won't. But you know, actually. You know, every time you cut away and open up the world, it's like a little miracle, right? It's like you're seeing through the Buddha's eyes. You're hearing with the Buddha's ears, right? It's so beautiful, so beautiful. You know, it's pretty clear that a lot of people here have been practicing with real passion, because we've all had a little taste of how the Buddha sees the world, right? All the people here have had a little taste of that freedom and that openness, right? That liberation. So please, as I always say, trust the process, right? All this time we're struggling to wake up, our enlightened mind is already helping us to wake up. You know, sometimes on the cushion, working on your koan, you can feel so lost. You could think, I'll never answer this koan. It's been months. But all so deep inside yourself, there's something that said, go to Sesshin. See, there's deep, like in yourself, there's a Buddha who is trying to help you wake up. So even when you feel like there's no answer, just trust. You know, your Buddha nature is already helping you. It's already on, coming to your rescue, right? Just trust. That's the essence. You know, you're working on your koan. You think, you know, I don't know where to turn. And suddenly, you know, you go into the Dokusan room. You may not even have realized yourself what you were going to say, and something comes out. You know. It's the voice of the Buddha speaking through your body, you could say. So it all starts with matsu, right? Okay. Daibai asked Basso, what is the Buddha? Basso answered, this very mind is the Buddha. Wu-men's comment, if you directly grasp Basso's meaning, you wear the Buddha's clothes, you eat the Buddha's food, you speak the Buddha's words, you do the Buddha's deeds, That is, you are the Buddha himself. However, alas, you know, Daibai misled not a few people by taking the mark on the balance for the weight itself, for confusing the path with the goal, right? How could he realize that even mentioning the word Buddha should make us rinse out our mouths for 3 days? See? In other words, you know, if you cling to the idea of Buddha, you are not in not knowing. You're not in not knowing. If a man of understanding hears anyone say, this very mind is Buddha, he will cover his ears and rush away. Okay. Mumon's verse, Lan Tian, the blue sky and bright day. No more searching around. What is the Buddha? With stolen money in your pocket, you declare yourself innocent.